content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the March 2nd, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a cemetery with rows and rows of similar or identical headstones with different markings. The one in the foreground says Parkland, February 14th, 2018, 17 killed, 14 wounded, with flowers and flags in front of it. Some of the other gravestones say Sutherland Springs, Las Vegas, Pulse Nightclub, Charleston, Newtown, Washington Navy Yard, Virginia Tech, Columbine. And then there's a picture also in the foreground of an ostrich. He's got his head in the ground, and he's got a symbol of the NRA on the side. And the title is Willful Blindness. Can Parkland students end the NRA's control of the gun debate? And that is one of our main stories, but it also shows up in the controversy of the week and in our long story feature, The Last Word. So we will take the other main story and then circle back to the Parkland shooting. Mueller indicts Russians for election interference. What happened? President Trump this week furiously downplayed suggestions that Russian meddling helped him win the presidency after special counsel Robert Mueller indicted 13 Russian nationals and three Russian companies for allegedly interfering in the 2016 election in support of Trump. Those charged were accused of working at the Kremlin-linked Internet Research Agency, a St. Petersburg-based troll farm that, according to the 37-page indictment, set out to sow discord in the U.S. political system by spreading disinformation and divisive memes on social media. The effort began in 2014, but as the presidential election approached, employees were ordered to use any opportunity to criticize Hillary Clinton and other Democratic and Republican candidates, except Trump and Senator Bernie Sanders, because we support them. Some Russians were in contact with unwitting individuals associated with the Trump campaign, but Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, announcing the charges, said there is no allegation in this indictment that any American was a knowing participant or that the Russian trolls altered the outcome of the 2016 election. Trump immediately declared vindication, tweeting, "The Trump campaign did nothing wrong. No collusion." But he later lashed out over the indictment in a weekend tweet storm, rebuking his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, for saying Russia's election interference is now incontrovertible, blaming former President Barack Obama for not preventing Moscow's meddling, and accusing FBI agents of failing to prevent the Florida high school shooting because they are spending too much time trying to prove Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. What the editorial said. So much for the idea that Russia meddling in last year's election was a hoax, said the Los Angeles Times. Mueller's indictment contains a dizzying level of detail about the Kremlin-led troll campaign, with Russians masquerading as Black Lives Matter activists on Facebook and buying online ads targeting battleground states that declared Hillary is a Satan. They organized rallies in the U.S. and spread fabricated quotes claiming Clinton wanted Sharia law. The aim was clear: to suppress the Democratic vote, move the election in Trump's favor, and strike at the heart of what America is. Yes, the operation was outrageous, said the New York Post. But as Rosenstein acknowledged, the indictment contains no proof of a Trump-Putin plot to steal the election. The Internet Research Agency began meddling more than a year before anyone thought Trump would run. The only reason the Russians began favoring him in mid-2016 is because Clinton was the clear favorite, and so the best target to slam to spread discord. Like everyone else, the Russians could never have dreamed that Trump would actually win. What the columnist said, Trump is far from exonerated by this indictment, said Abigail Tracy in VanityFair.com. Rosenstein spoke carefully. He acknowledged there was no allegation of collusion in this particular document, but the indictment says nothing about the hacking of the Democratic National Committee servers or Donald Trump Jr.'s infamous June 2016 meeting with Russian lawyer Natalia Valinitskaya. And while no one knows Mueller's next chess move, he just systematically laid out Russia's criminal activity, shattering the illusion of a witch hunt and making it harder for Trump to fire him. For all the alarmism, it's not clear Russian trolls impacted the 2016 result, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. Looking at the key states, the Russians spent $1,979 on ads in Wisconsin, $823 in Michigan, and $300 in Pennsylvania. This is not the stuff of rigging elections. Liberals are so determined to see Trump in an orange jumpsuit, said Wesley Pruden in WashingtonTimes.com. Few of them recognize the Russian game for what it is. President Vladimir Putin wasn't out to pick a president. He wanted to set American against American, which is exactly what Democrats do every time they shout collusion. We will likely never know if Russia's scheme changed the election's outcome, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. It's impossible to calculate exactly how many Democrats didn't cast a ballot because of the hacked emails and bot messages portraying Clinton as the corrupt, evil enemy of blacks and Sanders voters. The debate over whether our democracy was compromised will almost certainly run for years. And that, in and of itself, is an accomplishment for Russian counterintelligence. Our controversy of the week, the AR-15. Would a ban stem bloodshed? Who is crazier, asked Andre Oppenheimer in the Miami Herald. Nicholas Cruz, 19, the troubled former student who shot 17 people dead last week at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, or the society that let him buy an AR-15 rifle, a civilian version of the M16 developed for use in Vietnam. The semi-automatic AR-15 fires high-speed, low-caliber rounds that cause maximal damage within a human body, and it fires them very quickly, with little recoil to the shooter. Hence the horrifying death tolls of recent shootings in Las Vegas, Sutherland Springs, Texas, Orlando, San Bernardino, California, and Newtown, Connecticut. Take it from a gun enthusiast, said George Skelton in the Los Angeles Times. The short-barreled AR-15 is not a good hunting weapon. For self-defense, a shotgun or handgun is much more practical. The only real tactical reason to own an AR-15 with a 50-round magazine is to kill lots of people in a few minutes. That's why the AR and its variants have become the weapon of choice for mass killers, and why fully 68% of Americans, including 48% of gun owners, want them banned. It's simple. If we want to curtail mass shootings in America, the first step is to ban mass shooting weapons. Actually, it's not so simple, said Jacob Sullum in Reason.com. Americans own something like 15 million AR-15 style rifles. That makes any confiscation program a non-starter. It also tells us that these guns are almost never used to commit violent crimes. The fact is that rifles account for only about 2% of gun homicides each year. compared with 65% for handguns. Handguns were also used in 66% of mass shootings between 1982 and 2012, compared with only 14% for rifles. It may be true that so-called assault weapons have been used in the recent mass shootings with the highest death tolls, but if they're banned, killers could easily turn to semi-automatic handguns or other rifles. Taking away Americans' gun rights might save some lives, said John Davidson in TheFederalist.com, but there are things more important than safety. When the founders enshrined gun rights in the Second Amendment, they envisioned an armed population as a bulwark against military invasion from outside and military-backed tyranny from within. Civilian access to military-grade weapons preserves the right of rebellion and undergirds our entire political system. Liberals who demonize guns are fond of reminding us that when the Constitution was drafted, the deadliest weapon was a single-shot musket, said Daniel John Sobieski in TheAmericanThinker.com. But that's exactly the point. If the founders intended a rough parity between civilian and military hardware, then today an AR-15 is what the Second Amendment is all about. Even the late Justice Antonin Scalia would disagree, said Alan Steinberg in the New Jersey Star-Ledger. In the 2008 U.S. Supreme Court ruling D.C. versus Heller, which affirmed the right of individuals to own guns, Scalia wrote that the Second Amendment does not confer a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever. The government, he said, could properly ban dangerous and unusual weapons. It's for this reason that the sale of fully automatic weapons, sawed-off shotguns, and bazookas is banned. Assault rifles are every bit as dangerous and should be added to the list. Let's remember that the first civil right of Americans is the right to be free of domestic violence. As long as the nation remains awash in weapons of war, that most basic right is imperiled. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Hope it was a good week for you. It was a good week for clippings after a librarian at Union College in New York found in a 1793 almanac an envelope labeled Washington's Hair, containing a lock of silvery hair tied with a thread. Scholars say the hair is very likely the first president's. It was a good week for progress after the World Health Organization predicted that polio will finally be eradicated once and for all in 2018. Last year, there were only 22 reported new cases of the disease, which paralyzed or killed millions of children in the 20th century. It was a good week for withholding evidence. With the news that the suspected British drug mule mentioned last week in the space is still refusing to have a bowel movement, Lamar Chambers has not properly been to the toilet for some 33 days, a prosecutor told a court this week. But it was a bad week for aesthetics after multiple employees at Apple's new $5 billion headquarters in Cupertino, California, were treated for injuries after walking face first into its internal plate glass walls and doors. It was a bad week for national defense after a think tank study found that 3/4 of Americans ages 17 to 24 are ineligible for military service because they're too fat, have criminal records, or didn't graduate high school. The image of hardy, scrappy Americans who can do anything, the study's co-author says, is no longer accurate. And finally, it was a bad week for interpretation after Black Eyed Peas singer Fergie triggered a backlash with her sultry lounge jazz version of the national anthem at the NBA All-Star Game, which sounded like Marilyn Monroe impersonating Billie Holiday. Commentator Charles Barkley said Fergie's anthem left him feeling like he needed a cigarette. Moving on to the briefing page, the title of our article this week is The Global Water Crisis. With Cape Town nearing day zero, the world may be seeing a grim portent of a drier future. What is day zero? It is the date, currently set as July 9th, when officials believe Cape Town will run out of water. 3 years into the region's worst drought in a century, the reservoirs supplying South Africa's second most populous city are almost empty. Its 4 million residents are already restricted to just 50 liters of water each per day. Americans, by comparison, use about 370 liters, with heavy fines for those who exceed that limit. If the reservoirs drop below a certain level, officials will turn off the municipal supply everywhere except hospitals, schools, and other key institutions. Residents will then be limited to 25 liters a day, which they'll have to collect from one of just 200 stations around the city, one for every 20,000 people. With violence and unrest anticipated, armed police and soldiers will be stationed at each collection point. The government's first and foremost priority, says Patrick Reed, a sustainable water management expert at Cornell University, is going to be to try to quell anarchy. Can it be prevented? Day zero is by no means inevitable. The cutoff date has already been pushed back from April 16th, and the upcoming rainy season could replenish supplies. But experts warn that in the 21st century, water shortages will become increasingly common across the world as climate change makes prolonged droughts more common and more extreme. The rapid population growth that helped cause the crisis in South Africa, Cape Town has doubled in size in the past two decades, is happening everywhere. The global population is now projected to grow from today's 7.7 billion to 9.8 billion by 2050 and 11.2 billion by 2100. The World Meteorological Organization estimates that two-thirds of all humans on the planet will face periodic or frequent water shortages by 2025. A panel of retired U.S. military officials concluded last year that water scarcity will become a growing factor in the world's hot spots and conflict areas, with shortages leading to widespread civil unrest and violence, and water supply becoming a valuable tool in the operational strategy for belligerents. Which regions are vulnerable? The Middle East and North Africa are most likely to suffer. Rainfall in these already dry regions is forecast to decrease by 20% by the end of the century because of climate change, while their populations are on course to double to 600 million by 2050. The five countries with the lowest renewable freshwater resources per person are all in the Middle East: Kuwait, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Qatar. And Sana'a, Yemen's dry inland capital, is expected to run out of water within a few years. But there are shortages across the world. Pakistan's government has warned that the entire country will lack sufficient water as soon as 2025. Cities including Beijing, Shanghai, and Mexico City are pumping so much water out of underground aquifers that they are literally sinking. In the U.S., water levels in the country's largest reservoir, Lake Mead on the Colorado River, dropped 140 feet over 15 years and fell to 40% of capacity in 2015. Where is conflict likely? Flashpoints often occur where a river or aquifer stretches across national borders, raising questions over who owns the rights to the flow. That issue has become one of the key sticking points in the long-running standoff between India and Pakistan. In the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia has almost completed a $4.2 billion project to dam the Blue Nile with a massive hydroelectric power plant, a scheme that could reduce Egypt's share of water 2,000 miles downstream by up to 25%. No one can touch Egypt's share of water, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi warned last year. Water to us is a question of national security. Many believe water will become the oil of the 21st century, driving major geopolitical decisions and creating a dividing line between those who have it and those who don't. How can shortages be alleviated? One deceptively simple solution is to fix old leaky pipes, which account for about 40% of cities' lost water. Another is diversifying sources to make populous areas less reliant on reservoirs that are vulnerable to drought. Desalination plants are effective but very expensive, making them unsustainable for poorer countries. In Los Angeles, officials have covered the surfaces of four reservoirs with millions of 4-inch plastic balls and shade covers, a technique they say reduces evaporation by up to 90%, saving 1 billion gallons of water a year. Agriculture and industry, which use the overwhelming majority of the world's water supplies, could be given financial incentives to use treated wastewater rather than groundwater. The key, experts say, is preparation. Nature isn't particularly willing to compromise, said Mike Muller, former director of South Africa's Department of Water Affairs. There will be severe droughts, and if you haven't prepared for it, you'll get hammered. And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week. Two this week coming from the U.S. The first, tax bill helping the GOP. Democrats are far too confident about the midterm election, said Rich Lowry. President Trump's struggles, a string of special election victories, and historical trends favoring the party out of power all point to the likelihood of Democrats taking control of the House. But in recent weeks, the GOP has started to shrink the Democrats' once commanding lead, with at least one poll giving Republicans a 1-point edge in a generic House ballot. Trump's approval ratings have also climbed into the low 40s. Why? It turns out Republicans really did have to pass the tax bill so people could find out what's in it. Democrats falsely told Americans the tax bill would raise middle-class taxes, but then most people found they were actually getting bonuses or more money in their paychecks. While Trump and the Republicans are now getting credit for the tax cuts and the strong economy, Democrats are caught in a perpetual cycle of outrage over Trump. But it's not clear how much voters care about Trump's latest Twitter flurry or Byzantine details of the Russia investigation. The current interlude may not mean Republicans escape their hanging in the fall, but it gives them something in short supply before the tax bill passed. Hope, the ugly reality behind the Olympics. What are the Olympics good for? Asked Julia Ioffe. Yes, the games provide TV viewers with a few weeks of sumptuous spectacle, but the price of staging the Olympics every 2 years is unconscionable. Host countries spend billions to create the event venues, leaving them with white elephant stadiums and ruinous piles of debt for years. To make way for the 2008 Summer Games in Beijing, the Chinese government moved 1.5 million people out of their homes, and similar mass evacuations occurred in Rio de Janeiro, Vancouver, and Sochi. Despite the supposedly apolitical nature of the Games, they have been a stage for ugly ethno-nationalism since the 1936 Olympics in Hitler's Germany. The drive to prove national superiority has fueled multiple doping scandals involving the Soviet bloc and of modern-day Russia, as well as the U.S. and other Western nations. In Pyeongchang, Kim Jong-un is using his cheerleaders and figure skaters to sanitize his brutal regime and drive a wedge between South Korea and the U.S. Can we really pretend that the chance to watch a sport few watch except at the Olympics, curling, weightlifting, the bobsled, is worth all the corruption, waste, and political ugliness? This one comes from China. A dangerous flirtation with Taiwan. The U.S. is treading perilously close to a radical change in its relations with Taiwan, said Ling Xingli, The U.S. House of Representatives has already passed the Taiwan Travel Act, which encourages high-level diplomatic visits between America and Taiwan, and the Senate will soon vote on the legislation. If that bill becomes law, it would represent a serious deviation from the One China policy, under which the U.S. has formal ties with China, rather than the breakaway island of Taiwan. From 1949 until the 1970s, the U.S. recognized the imposter government in Taiwan instead of China's true government in Beijing, a historical error that must never be repeated. Even after the U.S. opened diplomatic relations with China in the 70s, it continued to test Chinese resolve over Taiwan, selling advanced weaponry to the island. But no U.S. administration has gone as far as that of President Trump, who actually tried to make the One China policy a tradable good between Beijing and Washington, as if China's core interest in Taiwan could ever be up for negotiation. If the U.S. passes this law and sends a top official to Taiwan, Beijing will be forced to take all possible countermeasures, including uniting China and Taiwan by military force. And it is time for the last word, our in-depth article this week dealing with the Parkland shooting. The title, In Parkland, Pain Turns Political. An outpouring of grief and anger always follows a deadly mass shooting, said journalist Kevin Sullivan, Tim Craig, and William Wan. But in Parkland, Florida, students and parents are turning rage into activism. On a day when Parkland began burying its young dead, a dozen people stood on a street corner holding up more gun control signs as passing drivers honked and shouted in support. Look what we started, said Carlos Rodriguez, 50, who was on his way to work when he stopped to join the protest last Friday. Look at all these people. One match started a whole forest fire. This most peaceful and orderly of places has been devastated by the most violent and chaotic of acts. And amid the horse trails, bike paths, and gated communities of a city that prides itself on country elegance, the response to a shooting last week that killed 17 people at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School has been a raw, growing, and furious burst of activism and demand for change. Hundreds of people filled the terrace of the Broward County Federal Courthouse over the weekend, where their echoing chants of enough and not one more weren't solemn. They were seething, none perhaps more so than Emma Gonzalez's. If the president wants to come up to me and tell me to my face that it was a terrible tragedy and how it should never happen, and maintain telling us that nothing is going to be done about it, I'm going to happily ask him how much money he received from the National Rifle Association, Gonzalez declared. To every politician who is taking donations from the NRA, shame on you. If you actively do nothing, people will continue to end up dead. In a nearly 10-minute address, her black tank top and tightly cropped haircut barely visible behind the podium microphones that stood nearly as tall, Gonzalez slammed by name senators who have proposed softening gun laws. Every few moments, the Stoneman Douglas High senior raised her bracelet-covered right arm to wipe tears from her eyes. In her left hand, she clutched her speech, written out by hand on a stack of college-ruled paper. She led the crowd in chants of No more BS. Gonzalez was one of half a dozen student speakers at the rally, many of whom noted that despite years of disciplinary issues, Nicholas Cruz, their former classmate, who police say has admitted to carrying out the shooting, was able to purchase a gun. This isn't just a mental health issue, Gonzalez said, her voice breaking into a scream. He wouldn't have harmed that many students with a knife. Grace Solomon, a city commissioner who is organizing a large group of parents and students to travel to Tallahassee, the state capital, and then to D.C. to demand common sense gun legislation, said there's been a palpable shift in the nature of her community. We're not a politically charged community. This is new because we've had enough, Solomon said. Parkland families have really involved parents. They are not going to take this sitting down, she continued. We have an army of moms who are tired of having their kids assaulted. Democrats and Republicans are coming together to find common ground we can bring to Tallahassee. Parkland, founded in 1963 on the swampy fringe of the Everglades, has long been a place of gentle ease, with great schools and well-educated and affluent population of about 32,000 people. It had no stores until the 1990s and still has only four stoplights, including one that just got left-turn arrows in the past couple of months. Its violent crime rate is a tiny fraction of the statewide rate, and city spokesman Todd DeAnglis said police are more likely to be called for a trespassing alligator than for a murder. Even its politics have a scrupulously fair balance. Although officials said the city, like all of Broward County, tends to lead Democratic, President Donald Trump won one local precinct by 16 points in the 2016 election and narrowly lost four others. But one of the deadliest school shootings in U.S. history has hit the city with a ferocity that has changed the calculation. Every community responds differently to the mass shootings that have become so frequent in the United States. Dancing showgirls and chapel wedding newlyweds were back in the streets of Las Vegas soon after a gunman sprayed bullets across a music festival in October, signaling a quick return to normalcy. In small-town Texas, a somber religiosity defined the aftermath of a church massacre that killed 26 in November. But Parkland has responded with a call to activism. Angry teachers, parents, and teenagers demanding stricter gun laws, more government money for school security, and better treatment for mental illness. This is going to energize a lot of people to vote this year, said Carl Hyason, a best-selling novelist and journalist who grew up in Plantation, just south of Parkland. People are angry. At a vigil Thursday night in the palm-lined heart of Parkland, people broke into a spontaneous and enraged chant of "No more guns! No more guns!" Many were students who are organizing on social media and calling for young people to lead the political charge. Annabelle Claprood, 17, was in Spanish class on Wednesday when she looked down at her phone. It was 2:32 p.m., the moment, she says, she became a lifelong advocate of gun control and new campus safety laws. At that moment, the shooting started. She took shelter in her classroom and heard every shot. Now the 17-year-old has decided to travel to Tallahassee to begin pushing for new campus safety laws. They said every time something like this happens, it's not going to happen again. But it's happening again and again. So we obviously are doing something wrong, Claprood said. You should not have a gun at the age of 18, said Claprood, adding that it makes no sense that at 18 you can buy a gun but not drink alcohol. Florida has relatively few restrictions on gun ownership. Unlike California, for example, Florida does not require background checks for private gun sales. It does not regulate sales of assault-style weapons and large-capacity magazines. Although federal law requires assault weapons buyers from a licensed dealer to be at least 18. State laws also prohibit cities from passing gun restrictions. Ashley Kurth, a culinary arts teacher at the high school, said her cooking class had just finished deep-frying shrimp when the gunfire began. She quickly locked the doors to her classroom and huddled with 65 students on the floor for 2.5 hours until a SWAT team broke a window to rescue them. Less than 24 hours later, Kurth was consoling grieving teachers and students before a vigil at Pine Trails Park. a public recreational facility with turf playing fields, an amphitheater, and high-end playground equipment. Many people arrived on bicycles or golf carts, using the community's winding network of paved paths. Kurth, 34, said she woke up the morning after the shooting wanting to sever her lifelong ties to the Republican Party. "The shooting opened my eyes and changed my views in a lot of ways," she said. "Before, I used to think, okay, let's be moderate. But living through that and experiencing that and seeing the aftermath of what that was, something has to be done." Asked about Trump's response to the shooting, Kurth sighed. "You know, I know he does his best with what he can, but at the same time, I am disheartened a little bit to hear, once again, we're going to focus on the mental illness and getting these people help," she said. "What are you going to do about the people who are sane and out there with their rights to bear arms that decide one day they just had enough?" she said. Sarah Lerner, 37, an English teacher, said she believed young people were going to force change on the gun issue. "Whether you are a right-wing Republican or a super-left liberal, we all want the same thing," she said. "No one should be afraid to go to school, and we all want to live in a safe community. And I believe this community is going to unite to make that happen." Bean Furr, the mayor of Broward County, which includes Parkland, said he was eager to give young people a chance to push for new gun legislation. "Those students who were at Douglas, they're good kids, smart students. They don't want this shooting to be their most enduring memory of high school," he said. "Several of them have told me they want the memory to be something that they help change, to let that be their legacy." Since the shooting, many people in Parkland who never expected to be involved in politics are suddenly finding themselves jumping in. "I am not a politician, but this made me angry. This happened in my backyard. I didn't know how easy it is to get a gun in Florida," said Cesar Figueroa, 43, who had two children at the school during the shooting. "They lost a teacher and two friends. I really want to make a difference," he said, calling for more stringent background checks for gun buyers. "I want to get involved and speak out." Jim Weiss, who has written a book about Parkland's history, said Parkland's activism comes from anger and confusion about how something so horrible could happen in a place so proud of its gentle nature. "People are outraged that something like this could happen in the safest city in Florida," said Weiss, 72. "This puzzle is missing some pieces. You know the way it should look, but you can't find those last pieces. And those pieces are about weapons and dollars and treating mental health." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. Pick up a couple of the health and science articles this week. First, a powerful new flu drug. As Americans cope with the worst flu season in a decade, the Japanese drug maker Shionogi says it has developed a new drug that can kill the flu virus within one day. In a human trial, just one dose of the experimental drug, known as Baloxavir Marboxil, cleared the virus three times faster than Tamiflu, which must be taken twice daily for 5 days. "The data we've seen looks very promising," the World Health Organization's Martin Howell Fried tells the Wall Street Journal. "This could be a breakthrough in the way that we treat influenza. When the flu virus enters our bodies, it hijacks cells and forces them to replicate the virus, making us very sick. Antivirals, including Tamiflu, help by preventing these flu copies from escaping through cells where they were manufactured. Shionogi's drug takes a more direct approach, preventing the virus from taking control of the cells in the first place. The fast-acting drug could make the virus less contagious and provide patients with more immediate symptom relief. The drug is fast-tracked for approval in Japan. Shionogi plans to apply for approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration this summer. Standing sheds pounds. The harmful effects of prolonged sitting are well established. New research suggests that spending more time on your feet, perhaps at a standing desk, is not only healthier, it can also help people lose weight. After analyzing 46 studies involving more than 1,000 people, scientists at the Mayo Clinic found that standing burns 0.15 calories more per minute than sitting. This seemingly insignificant difference can have notable effects over time. 6 hours of standing would burn an extra 54 calories per day. After 1 year, this could amount to a loss of 5.5 pounds. Those who keep it up for an additional 3 years could shed up to 22 pounds. The Los Angeles Times reports, standing for long periods of time for many adults may seem unmanageable, especially those who have desk jobs, says study author Francisco Lopez Jimenez. But for the person who sits for 12 hours a day, cutting sitting time to half would give great benefits. Fighting bacteria with dirt. Scientists have discovered a new antibiotic capable of wiping out several strains of superbugs, including methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, the MRSA virus. The new class of microbe-destroying molecules, known as malocedins, was extracted from microorganisms living in dirt, suggesting new weapons against drug-resistant bacteria could be lurking right under our feet. The Washington Post reports, every place you step, there's 10,000 bacteria, most of which we've never seen, says lead researcher Sean Brady. There's this reservoir of antibiotics out in the environment we haven't accessed yet. The vast majority of antibiotics are produced by fungi and by bacteria themselves in their ongoing competition against one another. But only about 1% of these microbes can be grown in petri dishes. The researchers bypassed this problem by removing DNA from 2,000 soil samples teeming with bacteria, cloning it, and injecting it into microbes that can be cultured in a lab. These microbes produced malocedin, which destroys the cell walls of bacteria. The molecule efficiently cleared MRSA infections in rats without inducing resistance. The development of a new drug will take years, but these findings point to a new strategy for combating antibiotic-resistant infections, which kill at least 23,000 Americans a year. We're on the Talking Points page now. First article, Mitt's return. Will he take on Trump? Mitt Romney is finally going to Washington, said Max Perry Mueller in Slate.com. A decade after his first presidential run, the former Massachusetts governor is now a shoe-in to replace retiring Senator Orrin Hatch, the Republican from Utah, after announcing his campaign for the Utah seat last week. One of the country's leading Mormons and a beloved figure in the heavily Republican state, Romney, 70, is on a mission to bring Utah's values to Capitol Hill, he said in his launch video, including the state's openness to immigration, its balanced budget, and its belief in treating one another with respect. Dignified and principled, Romney is perhaps the last hope for the GOP, said Siraj Hashmi in WashingtonExaminer.com. In 2016, he was one of our braggadocious president's most outspoken critics, calling the then real estate mogul a fraud and con man whose promises are worthless as a degree from Trump University. If he makes it to the Senate, Romney could provide a much-needed conservative check on Trump. Don't bet on it, said Deirdre Sheshgreen and Leonard King in USAtoday.com. There's certainly no love lost between Trump and Romney. The president has derided the one-time Republican nominee as a choke artist, but Romney has signaled he won't turn his Senate bid into an anti-Trump crusade. Instead, he's planning to serve as living proof that there's a traditional Republican alternative to Trumpism. When Trump unexpectedly tweeted this week that Romney would make a great senator, Romney thanked him. Whether Romney realizes it or not, said Kristen Tate in TheHill.com, it's Trump's party now. Romney had his chance to lead the GOP in 2012 and failed. The current political climate calls for a populist warrior, not a patrician statesman who favors amnesty for illegal immigrants and gave Massachusetts Romney care. For now, both Trump and Romney are hiding their mutual loathing, said Chris Saliza in CNN.com. The president knows Romney is close to a sure thing to win in the fall, and Trump likes being associated with winning. Romney, on the other hand, doesn't want the distractions of Trump savaging him on Twitter and demanding a pro-Trump primary opponent. And so here we are, with two men who are polar opposites in their personalities, their lives, their beliefs, each pretending to think the other is swell. Well, isn't that special? Security, the White House's Kushner problem. Remember when Donald Trump wanted to put Hillary Clinton behind bars for mishandling classified information? Asked Eric Levitson, NYMag.com. If Trump still holds that view today, he might need to lock up most of his own White House. It turns out that accused wife beater Rob Porter was far from the only Trump administration official allowed access to top secret information, despite not being approved by the FBI for a long-term security clearance. More than 130 administration appointees were working without long-term security clearances as recently as November, including top-ranking advisors like Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. It's not clear how many of these appointees were held up for bureaucratic reasons, but all signs suggest that some administration officials simply have things in their backgrounds that render them ineligible. Kushner will probably never get FBI clearance, said Emily Stewart in Vox.com. Yet the president's son-in-law views the president's daily brief, a digest of top secret intelligence, and often requests information from the intelligence community. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly this week announced he would revoke interim clearances for top secret information, a move that would seem to exclude Kushner from Trump's inner circle. But thus far, it doesn't look like he's going anywhere. Someone with Kushner's baggage would never have been allowed to serve in a normal White House, said Will Ron in CBSNews.com. Kushner had to make extensive corrections to security clearance forms detailing more than 100 foreign contacts. Hugely indebted due to a failing Manhattan real estate investment, Kushner has courted Chinese, Russian, and Saudi investors. It's possible that Rob Porter retained his security clearance, at least in part because nobody wanted to question the leniency afforded to Kushner. Alas, this isn't a normal White House, said David A. Graham in TheAtlantic.com. In past administrations, White House staffers like Porter and Kushner, who couldn't pass an FBI background check, were shown the door. But the Trump administration, very short on qualified staff, and suspicious of the deep state doing the checks, simply ignored these longstanding norms. What this White House didn't understand is that these norms also protect the president. If the White House had taken the FBI's recommendation about Porter seriously when received, it could have sidestepped the latest political catastrophe. Immigration, another Senate stalemate. The much-hyped immigration debate in the Senate has ended in resounding failure, leaving the dreamers in limbo, said Elena Shore and Burgess Everett in Politico.com. The most popular bipartisan proposal from the Common Sense Caucus offered a path to citizenship for 1.8 million dreamers who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children in exchange for $25 billion for border security. But that compromise was voted down last week, 54-45, a plan based on President Trump's demands, which combined Dreamer legalization, border wall funding, massive cuts to legal immigration, and the elimination of the diversity visa lottery program, was crushed with only 39 yes votes. Trump deserves all the blame for this stalemate, said Dara Lind in Vox.com. He canceled the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program last September, then promised to sign any compromise bill reauthorizing it before producing a laundry list of restrictionist conditions Democrats would never accept. Last week, he did everything he could to kill a deal, signaling that he'd veto any bipartisan proposal that didn't meet his unrealistic demands. Many Senate Republicans felt it was Democrats who were being unrealistic, said Haley Byrd in WeeklyStandard.com. They knew that the more conservative House, where bipartisan immigration bills go to die, would be unlikely to approve the compromises that Trump ardently opposed. Still, Trump blew a big opportunity here, said Gregory Krieg in CNN.com. He could have delivered on his dearest campaign trail promise, building a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, while solving an immigration issue that breaks heavily in Democrats' favor. Having successfully used the Democrats to get leverage for his wall, the president couldn't take yes for an answer. Now we're headed for a game of chicken, said Aaron Blake in WashingtonPost.com. Two federal courts have issued orders blocking Trump's cancellation of DACA as of March 5th, orders that the White House is appealing. Meanwhile, administration officials have said they will not prioritize deportation of Dreamers. Republicans hope the uncertainty for DACA recipients will eventually force Democrats to cave in to Trump's demands. Democrats think the GOP will crack once voters see Dreamers being deported because of an action Trump took. That's an ugly way to force a decision, but Congress usually fails to act until there's a crisis affecting real people. We've got a few minutes left, and looking for some comic relief. I saw a couple of pieces in the It Must Be True. I read it in the tabloid section that I'd like to read for you. First, a woman in southern China was so attached to her designer handbag that she climbed into a train station's X-ray security scanner to stay with it. The woman placed her shoulder bag in the luggage scanner as instructed, but shocked security guards by clambering onto the conveyor belt to ride along with it. Officials said her behavior was foolish, noting that radiation from the machine is incredibly harmful to human health. An Idaho man was arrested after he allegedly stole aluminum irrigation pipes from a farm to sell for scrap, and then drove off with the 40-foot poles sticking sideways out of his car's windows and into oncoming traffic. The pipes struck and damaged at least three cars driving in the opposite direction, and one victim called 911 to report the unusually wide load. Police charged suspected thief Brett Anderson with possession of stolen property and reckless driving. Officers said Anderson, 47, repeatedly told them this was the dumbest thing he'd done in his entire life. And a short note or two. As of mid-February, President Trump had held no news conferences for a full year and only one formal solo news conference in his entire presidency. His lagging presidents Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George H.W. Bush, who in the first year of their presidencies held 11, 4, 14, and 26 formal news conferences, respectively. Of the 144 seasonal worker jobs filled at three Trump Organization properties in New York and Florida between 2016 and the end of 2017, just one went to a U.S. worker. Foreign guest workers with H-2B visas got the rest. In that visa program, foreigners can be hired only if employers can't find Americans to fill the job. And we'll finish with a quote from Vincent Van Gogh, quoted in EliteDaily.com. Normality is a paved road. It's comfortable to walk, but no flowers grow on it. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.